Hey, hey everyone, and welcome to the Easter and April Fool's edition of Risky Business, episode number 146. I am Patrick Gray. This week's edition of Risky Business is hosted, as always, by Virtual Office in Sydney, but we're sponsored, most importantly, by Tenable Network Security, the makers of Nessus and other goodies. You can find them at tenablesecurity.com. Now, this is an April Fool's edition of the podcast, so I sort of flirted with the idea of coming up with some wild headlines to sort of sucker people in, you know, like I thought something as crazy as Google's network owned by the Chinese government, or massive botnet comprising millions of hosts uncovered, but unfortunately both of those things have happened. You know, I couldn't actually think of something that wouldn't be believed these days in the security industry. So this is how much fun the InfoSec beat is to cover as a journalist. I tell you what, though, the local press here in Australia have been having a bit of fun with the April Fool's thing. Both ZDNet in Australia and IT News, who are both fiercely competitive organisations with each other, they both ran the same April Fool's story, which is quite hilarious. Both outlets report Google is set to close its Australian operations over the government's planned introduction of a clean feed system. Nice one, guys. Both the editors there tell me that it's a coincidence and it wasn't staged, and I have no idea if I believe them or not, but either way, it's pretty lol-tastic. Anyway, it's a short week here because of Easter, and we had a couple of interview cancellations this week as well. So on today's show, we've only got two segments. We've got the news with Adam Boileau in just a tick, and then we're chatting with Tenable's chief executive, Ron Gula, about vulnerability scoring, and that is this week's sponsor interview. But before we get to all of that, a reminder that Risky.biz is currently trying to recruit some consultants for a couple of companies here in Australia. We're looking for PCI, pen test and security admin people in Adelaide and Sydney. And in Melbourne, we're looking for a pen tester with experience with web application auditing using BERT. So if any of these sound like you, please email jobs@risky.biz in complete confidence for more information. But it's time for a check of the week's news headlines now with our favourite beardy Unix guy, Adam Metalstorm Boileau. And Adam, let's all be on the lookout for nasty voice packets flying around on the intertubes because there are bugs in Cisco's implementation of SIP.
Yeah, so Cisco have dropped their half-yearly patch cycle release.
Excuse me? Did you just say half-yearly?
Yeah, yes.
I did not know that.
Yes, they have a six-monthly release cycle for iOS patches.
Oh, the speed of light.
Absolutely, yeah. So they patched, 11 vulns in iOS, and one of them, which apparently causes the box to reset remotely and may have a chance of remote code execution, is in their SIP implementation. And so they've released a patch, and there are no workarounds, apparently, other than installing the patch, except for not using your SIP, which is apparently what they recommend.
Yeah, so no more phone calls for you guys, basically.
They said businesses should try to mitigate the risk by only allowing trusted devices to connect to the affected device. So what you're saying is you don't want anyone to phone you.
Nice strategy. Look, I do think it's interesting that these bugs were found internally, though. So it was obviously part of some sort of internal code review. So to that extent, we have to congratulate Cisco on actually finding bugs in their own products, which is something, you know, most people can't really be bothered doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, given Apple can't patch them and other people find them, let alone find them themselves.
That's quite right. But look, it looks like a pretty bad one. You know, from what they're saying, it's a device reset thing, could be exploitable. I think reading between the lines, it's like, yeah, it's probably exploitable, but we couldn't be bothered finding out. I mean, that's what I take away from the advisory.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, exploiting vulnerabilities on iOS is something that, you know, the hacker community has put quite a bit of effort into, and it's still pretty difficult despite the work from FX and Michael Lin and those sort of people.
Yeah, it's a little bit exotic, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I guess, you know, having access to the test kit and being able to debug it well and having a development environment, you know, all of those things are quite high barriers to entry, you know, versus popping a shell on an OS X box.
Yeah. Look, meanwhile, I'm told that, you know, in the last 5 years, people have improved their patching processes for Cisco kit. I mean, it used to be people would not bother with their Cisco routers, you know, and there were all those options. You'd have to download, you know, images basically, and you'd have a different image, you know, if that had that option in it, or it had that particular type of expansion card in it, you know, and if you put the wrong image on it, you'd brick it and stuff, and people would stay away from it. But was it they call the system trains or train wreck?
Yeah, train wreck.
But exactly. It seems to have gotten better. So
Yeah, well, and that's, you know, that's good, I guess, especially given how important Cisco Kit is to, you know, securing everybody's environments.
Mm. Now, in this next story from Dark Reading, I can't believe we've actually seen these words in a headline, but the headline reads, Fog of War led to Operation Aurora malware mistake.
this is a pretty good headline.
It is a great headline, but I mean, the Fog of War, I mean, there was no war. But anyway, boils down to this. McAfee has said some of the malware that it said was part of this big, you know, state-sponsored cyber attack on Google was actually just coincidentally on the same machines. They had multiple infections and they weren't actually a part of that attack.
Well, I guess, you know, if you get owned by one set of IE6 drive-by malware, then, yeah, it makes sense. You probably got owned by something else. But, yeah, it does, I suppose it's not particularly surprising that, you know, there was some confusion around exactly which bits of malware are attributed to whose anonymous command and control server. And obviously, the whole point is not to make it clear who's doing what.
Well, I do kind of find it interesting that the average workstation at Google was actually, you know, loosely resembled a Petri dish, you know, full of infections. That's a surprise. This is interesting because it kind of meshes with that Damballa report. It makes that Damballa report make more sense because these were the guys who came out and said, you know what, we've looked at the malware and it looked kind of amateurish and not the work of, you know, state-sponsored dudes.
Yes, and of course, it makes a lot more sense that we now are actually talking about two or more sets of malware installed in the system, and some of them are crappy and amateurish and some aren't.
But yeah, this malware is apparently linked to another set of attacks on some Vietnamese websites, is that right?
Yeah, so the other bits, apparently this Vietnamese botnet, and apparently it's being used for carrying out denial of service attacks against people who are against bauxite mining in Vietnam. I think that was what I read. So it's some, you know, also politically motivated. So it's interesting that we're seeing that you know, in Southeast Asia.
Well, it's actually kind of funny because I mean, reading, you know, one paragraph from McAfee's report on this, their blog post, it says, "We believe that the perpetrators may have political motivations and may have some allegiance to the government of the Socialist Republic of Vietnam. The charter of the Vietnamese Professional Society," I believe these are one of the groups under attack, "is to increase the knowledge and understanding of the social and economic conditions in the Southeast Asian country," according to Wikipedia.
Yes, so McAfee being just a little vague in their blog posts there. You've got to worry about a report where half the paragraphs start with "we believe" or "we suspect."
Especially when those same paragraphs end with "according to Wikipedia."
Yeah, without a citation needed.
Yeah, no further citation needed. What makes me a little bit uncomfortable about this is I remember last year McAfee came out with their reports on what we're going to see in 2010, and they said politically motivated attacks are going to be on the rise, right? And this just fits their predictions too closely. It really does. And it seems like...
It's very convenient, isn't it?
It is very convenient. So I'm not utterly convinced that the government of South Vietnam is staging, you know, cyber attacks on the opponents of bauxite mines. I'm just not convinced yet. I mean, I'm sure you guys have got reams and reams of evidence. Just not convinced. Call me cynical.
Well, although apparently the mining company involved with the bauxite mining... is Chinese.
Oh, well, that proves everything, doesn't it?
Exactly.
All right, well, moving on to some other news. Oh, RIP SCO. SCO is gone. Wow. Ding dong, the witch is dead. You know, I can't believe it. SCO.
And thank God for that. It's about time. Truly, it is the year 2010 when SCO finally lost.
A Salt Lake City jury on Tuesday ruled against SCO Group's claim that it owned the copyright to the Unix operating system. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, this has been one of the biggest and most controversial lawsuits we've seen ever in the tech industry, and it's finally drawn to a close.
Yeah, well, it certainly had, you know, fairly far-reaching implications, you know, for open source and Linux and for the lawsuit against IBM, which is worth a fair amount of money.
$1 billion, I think it was.
Oh, yeah, $1 billion. But I think probably the most important thing that comes out of this is that I guess this is the end of Novell now, because the Unix copyrights are kind of a curse, right? You pass it on and the next company who gets it also dies. SCO, Caldera. I guess it's Novell's turn now.
Yes, I believe it will be. So we'll be watching for what force majeure takes them out. Moving on. Now, I love this headline. This is a friggin' awesome headline from Wired. It's Google, Microsoft push feds to fix privacy laws. Sort of an odd headline, wouldn't you say?
Yes, it certainly is. You know, companies that, especially in Google's case, make their money out of mining your private data and then selling you advertising based on it, asking the feds to tighten up on privacy laws.
Yeah, now I think asking Google to fix privacy is sort of like asking a tsunami to fix your beach house.
Yeah, it'll fix it good.
It'll fix it. It'll fix your wagon good. But yeah, this seems a little bit strange. I get mighty uncomfortable when I see companies like Google getting very cozy with the government and pushing for certain quote-unquote reforms, you know. But what are the key changes that they're pushing for here, Adam?
So actually, you know, beyond the, I guess, the cynicism which we are, you know, naturally prone towards, the actual changes they're talking about are not that silly. They are drawing comparisons between the level of judicial oversight in terms of a warrant or a subpoena for getting access to data stored in the cloud. So in the cases of email, traditionally, you know, you pull your email from your ISP. And if you pulled it to your local machine, deleted it off the POP server at your ISP, then they needed a warrant to go into your house and get the email. But if you left it on the server for, I think it was more than 180 days, then it was considered abandoned, and the feds could turn up at your ISP with only a subpoena, which is a much less rigorous level of oversight, and obtain access to the data. And Google and Microsoft and the rest of the people who are pushing this law change are basically saying that that's not a relevant distinction anymore, because you store your email in the cloud and, you know, potentially lots of your other data, and it should be afforded the same protection as it would were it on your machine locally and not stored in the network. So, you know, that's actually, I think, a pretty sensible thing to say. And I think what's going on here is that Microsoft and Google recognize that a level of trust is necessary to really push cloud computing and cloud data storage. And this is, you know, certainly one way that they can demonstrate that they are taking that sort of thing seriously. So, you know, despite being cynical, it is actually a fairly sensible thing to suggest, I think.
Was there anything else in there like, oh, and by the way, we think we should be free to microchip people, read their minds?
Well, I mean, almost certainly there'll be, you know, 400 pages of small print. But, I mean, that was the main push of at least the article that we're discussing. I thought another interesting little side note was there was an interview where the author of the article was talking to one of Microsoft's general counsel people and about the takedown message that they sent to Cryptome. And he said that it was an unfortunate situation where the intellectual property lawyers at Microsoft didn't realize the impact of their use of a copyright takedown notice. Yeah, I guess they hadn't heard of Cryptome, huh?
Well, possibly not.
Well, exactly. But, I mean, yeah, I'm sure they do now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it did strike me as something where someone was just being a little bit overzealous, honest. Because, look, that was their law enforcement manual or something?
Yes, it was.
That stuff. I mean, I've seen heaps of those documents over time. There was a Yahoo one that was leaked a while ago. It's all really mundane stuff. It's basically the guide that they give to law enforcement agencies and say, look, if you want to, you know, execute a warrant, if you've got a court-ordered warrant to access some data, here's how you actually go about doing it. Here's who you have to contact. This is the sort of paperwork you have to file. It is the most mundane of mundane documents. So I was surprised there was a flap about it in the first place.
Well, I mean, I think the fact that there are dollar values on those amounts, I suppose, captures people's imagination when they know that it only costs $25 and a warrant to get your data at all, whatever
the numbers
were. Yeah, but
it's the warrant part that is in, you know, that actually makes it okay. It's a court-issued warrant.
Well, and that's the whole point of this, right, is that requiring a warrant for more things rather than merely a subpoena or some of the other, you know, less transparent mechanisms that don't involve getting a warrant.
I totally agree with you there. Like, just having to get a subpoena and $25 to get my emails, yeah, no, not real cool, but I don't live in the US, I'm lucky enough to live in a country where the police don't have the resources required to do that sort of snooping. It's awesome. It's totally win. Take that, big economy. Anyway, moving on, and Apple has patched about, if I'm reading this correctly, the number of vulnerabilities they've patched in their latest update is around a...
The technical term is a hergillion.
Yeah, I think it's a gazillion, actually. Yeah. What was yours?
It's a hergillion.
Walk us through this one, Adam.
Apparently Apple are patching...
That was a very telling little slip.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it? Truly, the times have changed.
That's right.
No, so Apple are patching apparently up to more than 90 flaws in Snow Leopard and Leopard across a range of services and components. QuickTime, I think, is getting a bunch, as well as some of the core things, core audio, mail, file sharing services, that sort of thing. Bugs in iChat, Safari, the whole kind of, you know, laundry list of Appleware. is rolling out patches. So yeah, I guess, you know, if you're a Mac user and you don't already feel secure enough through your you know, your blind faith or a healing, then maybe you'd like to patch.
Could be a good idea. It was funny actually seeing some of the security types, because I know plenty of guys in the security industry who run OS 10 because it's, you know, it's all POSIX under the hood and it's heaps, you know, heaps of fun. You can compile
it's just like a Unix from the 80s. Yeah, yeah. You remember how secure they were.
Exactly. But the funny thing is, you know, I've seen some tweets going around on Twitter just going, you know, oh my God, you know, along those lines. They're just, even the true believers are having a hard time swallowing this one.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, right, you only need one bug. You don't need 90.
Yeah, well, and there's a gazillion, what is it?
A hajillion.
Hajillion out there at the moment. So Apple users, go forth and patch. But apparently, I can't imagine that's going to do you too much good. I mean, if they can find that many bugs, I'm sure there's more.
Yeah, well, when Charlie Miller's got, what, another dozen or something, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, he just wrote a basic fuzzer and then found, you know, another gigazillion.
Yeah.
But anyway, moving on, there's also been a Microsoft patch release, 10 IE holes.
Yet another, you know, out-of-band IE patch release. And, yeah, I guess really, you know, you should be pretty used to it by now. It should be a smooth process. You're pushing it out, getting the patches, you know, tested in your test lab, rolled out with your management system, and it's all done, right? Easy, no problem. Right? Right? Right?
That's how it works on Planet Unicorn.
Totally.
But, you know, I've got to say, you know, some of the tools are pretty good. You've got, you know, if you're using SCCM with SCUP, which is the System Center Update Publisher, which sounds way
not
better
manager.
Than, not manager, not System Center Update Manager. But, I mean, at least Microsoft have the tools now which make patching a relatively painless process, you know.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's been a long, hard road getting here. But, yes, finally, like, the management tools for an enterprise full of Microsoft machines are smoother than anybody else's.
They are, which, you know, isn't saying as much as we'd like it to, but it's still yeah. saying something.
I'm sure Oracle will roll out something totally best of breed with Solaris now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man, just don't get me started on Oracle or we'll be here all day. Anyway, now this is one that we actually missed last week. I thought we'd actually cover it now. There was an interesting little thing that happened in, where was it, Chile and the US, where some bright spark decided to point, you know, to start grabbing DNS data from a Chinese root DNS server, which would be awesome, except that's how they actually filter a lot of websites.
Yeah, so this is pretty funny. There was an interesting thread on the Nanog list, I think, about it, where they were discussing, you know, exactly what was going on. And yes, the root cause appeared to be that someone was running their queries through a root server in China, and the Chinese name server was blindly string matching for things like Facebook and YouTube and MySpace. Mm. And then returning bogus A records and associated things for names that you looked up through them. And this had leaked out into a couple of ISPs that were unknowingly or, you know, perhaps unintentionally using these Chinese DNS servers. I'm not quite sure whether it was some kind of Anycast thing or whether there were networks being BGP announced in a way that they weren't supposed to be, or exactly how it happened. I haven't read the technical details, but yeah,
well,
the net result was.
Danny McPherson at Arbor, he's quoted, he's been a guest on the show a few times. He's quoted in this article as saying, yeah, it was some sort of BGP thing.
Yeah, so I mean, the net result being that you sort of end up being behind the great Chinese firewall by virtue of living in Chile.
Yeah, or the US, some parts of the US. And wouldn't you just love it if you're sitting in America and, you know, you try to find some controversial YouTube video about the Tiananmen Square massacre? You know, that massacre that, according to the Chinese government, is where all of the guys jumped out of the tanks to give the students flowers and foot rubs. I think that's the official history version. But imagine if you're trying to look up a video of that. And, you know, instead you're redirected to a page which says, you know, thank you for attempting to access subversive material. A team of people is on their way to your house to torture you. Have a nice day.
Yes, a very nice day indeed.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, and certainly I think it's interesting also in light of the issue with Pakistan. It was a year ago, 2 years ago now, where they ended up blocking YouTube by accidentally leaking their BGP black hole route for YouTube out on the public routing tables.
Yeah, they absolutely it wasn't even fat-fingered. They just did a more specific announcement. You know, it was the ISP in Pakistan that was ordered by the government to block YouTube. So they just thought, I'm going to be clever and do a BGP announce and tell all of my routers that YouTube now is on that null interface on that box in that cabinet over there.
Yeah, and unfortunately, their upstream propagated the /32 announcement or whatever it is, and bam, end of YouTube.
All across the world, yeah. And it wound up taking down, I think it was YouTube for 50% of users, which is kind of cool. Yeah. You know, the Arbor guys did a fantastic analysis of that. I think, you know, if people are interested, they can find Dr. Jose Nazario's talk from GovCert last year on BGP. And the money quote from that one was, frankly, it's a miracle the internet works at all.
Yeah, amazing we get dial tone.
It is. Now, look, this next piece I pulled off CNET, it's not news, but I pulled it off CNET because I think it's a really, you know, for people who work in security, it's kind of a heartwarming story about people doing it right. And you don't see this very often.
Yeah, it's the sort of the nice piece at the end of the news where we have the skateboarding cat being rescued out of a tree by a fireman.
Pretty much.
And so, yeah, this particular company, Cryptography Research, they run two completely separate networks. You know, this is a private enterprise. It's not a crazy government. They're not the sort of dot mil types. But they, you know, they have two machines on everybody's desk, two completely physically separate networks with separate printers and separate file servers. And one of them's for internet and email and web browsing, and the other one's for actual work.
And you know what? They've never been owned.
Well, that they know of, done. But no, it sounds by all accounts a relatively successful story. And you know, they compare the cost of running dual everything and, you know, paying two lots of licenses and having two sets of servers and cabling and things with the amount of money and effort and time you have to spend securing an integrated network that you trust for browsing and business. And, you know, it appears that they're coming out on top, which, you know, I think it's a great story.
Yeah, no, I thought it was very interesting as well. And if people are interested in reading that case study, which was written by Eleanor Mills, they can find it under the headline, How One Company Stays Safe with Two Networks.
Yes, although having, you know, further on down the article, they discuss how they get data off the business network and over the internet to the, you know, the people they work with, their customers, their business partners. And it says they do this by PGP encrypting the file they want to send, putting it onto a flash drive, moving the flash drive onto the unsecured network, and then emailing the PGP. So it's never in the clear on the unsecured network. And that sounds like a great thing. But, you know, certainly my experience of using PGP in a business environment is it's a damn hard sell to get your customers using any sort of secure email, whether it's SMIME or PGP, you know, or any other, you know, kind of half-assed way of doing it.
Yeah, it probably helps that these guys are actually a crypto company that know how to use PGP.
Well, yeah, I guess so, yeah.
But, you know, it is just a sign that it can be done and it doesn't have to be prohibitively expensive.
And I suppose the point here is that there are other options than trying to secure your damn fat Windows desktops loaded with 5 to 7 IDS or IPS or AV products.
That's it. All right, well, moving on to our final story of the week. And there's a nice little kit out there. What is it, like $100? You know, you can build this kit now that enables you to sniff lots of commonly available wireless keyboards and other devices. So this is kind of cool.
Yeah, so the at Kansik West, a researcher or two unveiled the open source software and firmware and hardware that you can build to eavesdrop on Microsoft wireless keyboards. They appear to use some fairly trivial sort of encryption. It sounds like XOR with a repeated key over the airwaves. And then from there, you can sniff keystrokes or indeed inject your own.
Nice.
Yeah, well, that's kind of handy. Like, you wait for someone to type, you know, CMD, enter, and then all of a sudden you can slip in with the, you know, Deltree C minus Y.
Oh, that's old school, man.
Yeah. That's a beautiful thing.
It is a beautiful thing. Well, look, Adam, that takes us to the end of this week's news. Thank you for joining us, and have a happy Easter, and we'll chat to you next week.
You too. Yeah. Happy Bunny Jesus Egg Day.
Happy Jesus Bunny Day. Okay. We'll leave it at that.
See you, man.
Adam Boileau joining us via satellite from our Middle Earth studio there with a look at this week's news headlines. It's funny, actually. I recently had a guy write to me to tell me he'd stopped listening to the podcast because I used the words GD, which I can only assume, I can only assume he's referring to goddamn. And it's just as well he stopped listening, because if he heard Adam refer to Easter as Jesus Bunny Egg Day, I think his head would explode. We're mostly heathens in ANZ, everyone, in Australia and New Zealand. But sorry if I'm offending anyone. Not my intention, all of that. I don't know. Moving on. Normally we'd have our feature interview now, but between me losing a couple of days last week when I caught a cold and it being a four-day week here in Oz this week, I just wasn't able to pull together a feature interview. Shocking, I know. We'll be back to our regular format next week, but in the meantime, it's time for our sponsor interview with Tenable Network Security's Chief Executive Ron Gula. And we're chatting about an oldie but a goodie, vulnerability rankings. InfoSec wonks tend to get a bit carried away when it comes to exotic threats, often to the detriment of looking after the dumb stuff, like patching Adobe Reader, for example. While we might like our bosses to invest in heavy drapes to mitigate the latest laser-borne acoustic remote keyboard logger technique, the fact is we're more likely to get popped by something completely mundane, like a, unpatched bug in a browser. But how do we know which ones we need to prioritize, and can we apply the same measure of criticality to all vulnerabilities, or should they be scored differently by each organization? Tenable Network Security's chief executive Ron Gula knows a few things about bugs. The company's product Nessus is one of the oldest and best known, if not the best known, vulnerability scanners out there in the market today. Ron Gula joined me by phone from the US to talk all about vulnerability rankings.
There's vulnerabilities that come out, and a lot of them have a rating that has to do with the Common Vulnerability Scoring System, CVSS. I've actually had customers, call up and say, hey, we really want to challenge you on, the rating for a certain vulnerability. Maybe they want to argue it's a 7.9 instead of an 8. And really what they're saying is, at their organization, they've got to patch everything 8 and higher. And if they can get that knocked down to 7.9, they don't have to do that patch. And that's happened several times to us, and it's not why these vulnerability ratings are there. I find that very, very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, how do you rely on external ratings for vulnerabilities when each organization, they're all like snowflakes, aren't they, networks? I mean, you can't say that, this bug is going to have X, precisely measured impact on organization A, which is a, company that runs a website, versus, a massive government network across, federal government network across all of the US states. I mean, it's going to be a completely different sort of impact, isn't it?
Yeah, I really see that the vulnerability metrics, the vulnerability scoring, so to speak, comes in when you're resource constrained, right? If you have enough resources to say, look, everything on my network is going to run this way. It has this firewall rules. It's going to be packed this way. It's going to be configured this way. It's going to run this type of software. Those people don't really care about vulnerability scoring. They really don't. But if you're in charge of a huge server farm and you have no control over patching, and the patching team's coming to you and say, hey, where do we start? It's really nice to have some industry metrics and some best practice standards. Say, well, hey, there's the things we should start with. The problem is that, there's a lot of different metrics out there, and there's the ones that come from the vulnerability scanning vendors, and every one of those vendors feels very proud and very justified. There's some brilliant people out there working at some of the folks we compete with. But, each of these standards is a little bit different. And then, I talk to a lot of customers who have their own standards. They have their own sort of dash of either politics or what's important to their organization or availability or things like that. So I've never seen the same standard for scoring vulnerabilities used, outside of, generic things like CVSS scores.
Well, and then you've got companies like Microsoft that come up with their own scores, which now have, they're like critical or whatever with the exploitability index or rating of, X number. And, they're always kind of funny because I've always said, just because Microsoft's own geeks can't get something to trigger doesn't mean some other guy can't,
So if, for people who are listening to this, if they're familiar with CVSS, there's the base score, right? And the base score is that's sort of the substance of the score. Is it exploitable? How bad is it, right? But then there's two other modifying factors that you can optionally add in. One is temporal, which is the idea that maybe if the vulnerability ages, we're somehow less concerned or less vulnerable. And the other one's environmental. And so in other words, if this vulnerability is maybe on important stuff, it's going to have a higher score. And if it's on least important stuff, maybe it's going to have a lower score. But I've just seen that put into practice in many, many different ways that makes my skin crawl.
So don't get me started on this whole too critical to patch thing, because that is the biggest oxymoron I've ever heard in this industry.
There's it's too critical to patch, but then people start looking at it and they realize that the entire network is important. There's really nothing that's on our network that isn't supposed to be there, and there's certain things like, okay, well, maybe I have a DNS server and I have two failover DNS servers. Well, maybe if the failover DNS server goes down, it's not a big deal. Well, wait a second. If it goes down, it's not a big deal. Why is it still there? I think if that secondary DNS server goes down, it's a huge deal. So you have a lot of subjectivity when it comes to looking at that.
Yeah, it's funny. I was actually reading some chat logs today from Albert Gonzalez, there were some chat logs about his him talking to other guys about their attack on JCPenney. And, you know, it looked like they were pretty much going after whatever they could once they got a foothold in a network, and then, you know, just finding a point where they could actually sniff out some good data. But it seemed pretty arbitrary. They're like, oh, yeah, I own this box, and then, you know, saw what I could see, and then I own this one, and, you know, this is what I got. It was interesting little read, actually.
I guarantee you in those chat logs, and I have not read those, I guarantee you at one point they said, hey, this machine has a lot of vulnerabilities with very, very high CVSS scores. Let's start there.
What do they call it? The low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to look at it a lot different way. I mean, with automated tools, they're going to find, you know, different. And whatever is there, you know, if there was 300 vulnerabilities that you could exploit and you rank them and you get rid of the top 50%, you might congratulate yourself, but a determinist hacker is just going to use the bottom 50%. So that's why I have a big problem with these rating systems. It's really only good for prioritizing when you have limited resources. Now, everybody's going to say, hey, look, we have limited resources, but that's just because they approach network security from the, you know, scan, patch treadmill, and they can't get off of that. They really need to design networks to be rugged, to be survivable, to, you know, to basically do their job.
Now, this is the general thrust of a talk that you're preparing. Where are you doing that?
So we try to do a webinar, every quarter. That's a fairly big webinar. Marcus Rainham and I did a one on advanced persistent threat last quarter. We're going to do one. If you go to the blog.tenablesecurity.com and look for the vulnerability metrics webinar that's coming up, what we're going to try to do is talk about the different ways you can go about collecting metrics for your organization. We're going to start talking about some really basic stuff, right? What is a vulnerability ranking? Why might you want to use CVSS? Why might you want to use what a vendor is? Why might you only want to start with the highs or the lows? Who's looking at these different things? But also we're going to talk about things like, if you're scanning a network, when is the best time to scan? Is it the day before Microsoft Tuesday? If you're only scanning once a month, is it on Microsoft Tuesday? You know, do you want to guarantee that you're finding results? Do you want to guarantee that you've given your team a chance to patch?
It's kind of funny, isn't it? It's like you've got to ask yourself what sort of results you want before you do the test.
Well, but if people really think about it, you know, and I talk to people a lot, say, hey, use Nessus, that's great. Do you use credentials? Yeah, that's great. I said, when do you scan? You know, oh, we scan every Wednesday. I said, well, why is that? Well, our management shows that. Well, do you want to see vulnerabilities or do you not want to see vulnerabilities? And they always ask me, like, well, why does that matter? I said, well, what are you reporting on, right? Because if, let's say, your IT team really does a good job and they can patch everything within 30 days, then if you're scanning at any time, really all you're doing is basically doing a list of all the vulnerabilities that have come out over the last 30 days. And if that's all you want, I mean, Nessus is great. It's going to find all those things. But, you know, the reality is you can just go and read a bunch of blogs and figure out what those things. You don't need to have a scanner to protect those vulnerabilities.
I guess what you're getting at here is you know, you want to use your scanner to find gaps in your process, not just a nice little laundry list of bugs that you're about to patch.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, that makes sense. Hey, you know, speaking of these CVSS scores, who actually does them? Is that MITRE?
Well, so NIST puts out, NIST runs something called the National Vulnerability Database. And the majority of the vulnerabilities have, they all have CVE entries, so common vulnerability enumerations. The majority of them also have CVSS scores. MITRE happens to be the contractor that NIST is using. They've used others in the past, and they basically score these. Now, I've talked with a lot of the other CTOs and research staff from other vulnerability companies, and we always end up, as a community, tend to submit, you know, tweaks, submissions, modifications to a lot of those scores, because I think the vulnerability vendors tend to do probably a deeper job QAing these things. Plus, we also have a much, much, much larger customer base where they're going to say, hey, you know, let's read this vulnerability. It really is exploitable, different things like that. So we all use the CVSS formula. But perhaps, you know, somebody who's actually writing a vulnerability check is going to test, you know, is this particular exploit something I need local privileges for? Can I do it with the network? Is it a denial of service? Is it remote execute code? Can I exfiltrate data? And if somebody doesn't test all those different things, they're going to get a slightly different score than perhaps than what's out there. So the majority of it these days comes from NIST, but I think there's still a really big feedback loop from the vendor community. Mm. If you look at all these different places that had compromised computers, compromised different types of systems, if you go back to like the Mandiant report on APT and whatnot, It's how these computers were used. These computers surfed the web. These computers were on a VPN. These computers were used in a certain way. And I really believe, and this is where that environmental factor of the CVSS score comes in, we are really, really not understanding that. Is it just, I've talked to a lot of customers that, oh, this computer surfs the web, so it's potentially subject to attacks. Well, I think surfing the web and going to Facebook are two completely different things. You know, surfing the web and coming in over an internet, over VPN from international software development company that just outsources software for a living, those are two completely different things. So I don't think we have a good way to, from a metrics point of view, really, really talk about all the different use cases for activity on the internet. And activity these days is really what drives risk.
So what's the solution to this big, you know, metrics? I mean, what it is, it looks like metrics these days throw up more questions than answers, I suppose, is what I'm getting at. What's the solution for people out there? I mean, should they just ignore the metrics, or should they apply them in a certain way? What's your take on this?
I think that the more security people can do to minimize complexity, the better off they are. Now, there's a lot of people who say, hey, a certain product or technology is better and more secure than something else, right? We used to all say Linux was more secure than Windows. Now we're saying OS X is more secure than Windows. Now maybe Windows isn't so bad. You know what? If I've only got to worry about one type of technology instead of eight types of technology, I can really focus on making that one type of technology the best, defend that the best to my ability. And that's really what I believe. So, you know, if that means enforcing what browsers people use, great.
So so you're not a believer of Dan Gear's monoculture argument?
Well, the monoculture is a very, very good argument, right? So if you really tighten everything down, then the argument against that is one silver bullet, I can take out your entire network. But the question is well, do you really, the opposite of that surely isn't true. Surely we don't want to go around and run a unique operating system and a unique browser and a unique email client on every desktop. You know, so then a lot of people say, well, I want two or I want three to have some resilience. And I'm like, well, surely that is not an optimal way of growing this. So I still really believe that at the end of the day, it comes down to resources. And a monoculture is much, much, much easier to maintain and run, and it has a much lower cost than something else. And if you have a lower cost, boy, you have a lot more time to go look for APT. You have a lot more time to deploy. You have a lot more time to do forensics. You know, you're not spending time doing patching, figuring out why you're crashing and things like that. So I'm definitely much more in favor of monolithic systems than I am doing that. There's probably a lot of people who have been around a little bit longer than I have who remember the mainframe days going, yeah, we're heading back to that.
Look, I totally hear you. Rigid SOE, and you know, if you've got one thing set up right, it's pretty easy to control. Well, Ron, that's all we're going to have time for, mate, but we appreciate you coming onto the show as always, and we'll speak to you again in a few weeks.
Keep up the great work. I've really enjoyed your last couple interviews, and thanks for all your listeners.
Ron Guler on the line from the USA there in this week's sponsor interview, and that wraps up this week's edition of the Risky Business Security Podcast. This week's track is by Lawrence Kennedy, and you can download it for free from lawrencekennedy.com. That's Lawrence spelt with an L-A-W. It's called Seaside. Enjoy your Easter break, and until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.